This is Amanda Vanstone, welcoming you to this week's edition of Counterpoint. On today's program, NAPLAN, the National Literacy and Numeracy Test, much maligned by critics who say it's useless and irrelevant. There are also those who say results can and are being manipulated by some schools. Today, we'll hear the opposite view from an expert who says NAPLAN is valuable, is important, and is working. Also today, the art of grace. What is grace, or being gracious? We'll hear today from the author of a new book who says the human race lost the art of grace sometime mid-last century. It's all about moving well through life, and we'll find out how to do that later in the show. But first today, Hillary Clinton. From the Whitewater saga to the controversy over emails from the State Department, there are continuing concerns over how she deals with the truth. In fact, our first guest today says she is a congenital liar. Jeffrey Lord, a former advisor to Ronald Reagan, says when Hillary Clinton took on the role as Secretary of State for the Obama administration, she had a chance at a fresh start. But, he says, she blew that chance in record time by again being loose with the truth. Jeffrey Lord joins us via Skype from the United States. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
Well, the return of the congenital liar. Now, the person who first called her that, who was that?
The person who first called her that was the late William Safire, who was a longtime columnist for the New York Times. And back in January of 1996, as the last year of the first Clinton term dawned, Hillary Clinton had been caught up in over her time in the White House and in the run for the White House in 1992 in things ranging from a revelation that she had made a sudden $100,000 in cattle futures. She didn't have a particularly good explanation for this, which and what explanation there was eventually was figured out to be untrue. She was caught in the so-called Whitewater scandal, which was a real estate situation that the Clintons had gotten themselves into in Arkansas, and had been found to be less than truthful about that. As time went on after that column, and so in other words, Mr. Safire wrote this column and said, he began by saying, well, she's a role model for women, and she's very bright and all of these things, but unfortunately, our first lady is a congenital liar.
Dear.
You can imagine seeing this in the New York Times. This caused quite the commotion at the time.
Mm.
A little later, during the whole Monica Lewinsky situation with the special prosecutor in this, she was called to testify before a grand jury, and the first lady to ever have been called before a grand jury. The prosecutors had a meeting to decide whether or not she should be charged and prosecuted herself. And they decided that they didn't quite have the goods on her. Prosecutorial staff agreed that she was, in fact, lying to them. My point in all of this is, here we are all these years later. She had a clean slate when she became Secretary of State. And here we are again in a situation where people question her integrity. We had a poll here. We have Quinnipiac University, which is conducts very respected polls on issues and candidates of the day. And they had one last week, I think it was, in which one of the questions was to the respondents was to just free associate, to just give them, the pollster, a word that they associated with the particular candidate.
Yeah.
The pollster didn't suggest any words. That was up to the respondent. Well, now these are the raw numbers. 173 people, and that I forget what the sample size, but that was huge, said that the first word that came to mind when they thought of Hillary Clinton was liar.
Mm.
Right behind that were 80 some odd people who said she was dishonest. And then there was a third one there.
Ouch.
I forget what it was, but it had to do with her integrity. I mean, it was really quite startling and quite the news story here on all the news networks and the cable news networks, et cetera. So, and then today we find out that the person who set up her server, her computer server, is going to take the Fifth Amendment, which means you do that generally if you don't want to incriminate yourself. The Fifth Amendment being part of the United States Constitution, and it's provided there so that you can have some protection, not only against incriminating yourself, but not putting yourself in a situation where you testify and, you know, your testimony conflicts and then you're guilty of perjury.
There have been recent articles on Hillary on this issue, and in those articles there is often a discussion about staffers in the past and likely in the future doing just this, because they might feel pressured at one time to take a particular position and say a particular thing, but when it comes down to backing what they've said in the past or prison, they don't choose prison. They choose another, look after themselves and take, the Fifth Amendment.
This just keeps happening throughout her career from beginning to end. It's always the same question. People simply don't trust her and they think she's not honest. And
yeah. It is a big mountain to climb, isn't it? You can't really say, trust me. The New York Times article you refer to that William Sapphire wrote, now, if I recall correctly, at one time he was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon. But even Democrats admired him as a speechwriter, and he edited a fabulous book called Lend Me Your Ears, which is, for any speechwriter. A criticism from him of that type would be particularly biting. But the headline on that article was Blizzard of Lies.
Right.
I mean, that's when no one's sort of saying, hey, maybe she's a liar. This is pretty full on.
Right. It is just remarkable. We used to have a comic strip here. I don't know whether it was ever run in Australia, called Peanuts.
Yes.
And it was about a bunch of kids, and there was a character in there called Pigpen. And he was always drawn with this swirl of mud around him and a little cloud over his head.
Yeah.
And no matter where he went, this cloud of dirt was always over his head. And you just get this impression that this is exactly what's going on here, that no matter where she goes or what she touches, this kind of problem follows her.
Well, what would it take for the United States population generally to come to their senses about this? I mean, if it's true that the polling, and I'm not suggesting it isn't, shows this, that a high number choose liar followed by dishonest, I mean, not much between those two, it's hard to see that people would say, well, yeah, we're going to vote for her anyway, but that's what people think is going to happen.
Well, the thing is, there's sort of a lack of candidates. Now, one of the candidates that's getting huge crowds is Vermont's United States Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist. I'm not describing him in that fashion. He calls himself a socialist.
Sure.
He's getting a huge response out there, and he is really nipping at her heels in the polls. I don't think that Bernie Sanders could get nominated, although you never know. The Democratic Party once upon a time nominated George McGovern, who then proceeded to lose 49 states to Nixon. And 4 years before that, they gave real consideration to Eugene McCarthy, who was a senator from Minnesota, and he upended the then sitting Democratic president Lyndon Johnson and, you know, basically got him to not run again. And he didn't get the nomination, but he certainly had an effect on it. And then hanging out there is Vice President Biden, who is a very sympathetic figure in America these days. The loss of his oldest son, whom he was quite close to, I think he was 40, and suddenly died of brain cancer. And it was quite a, you know, personal tragedy.
Mm.
And I think that the question is, does the vice president have the emotional fuel, as it were, to get out and do this? But I can say for sure that a lot of the Democratic donors are watching all of this stuff with Hillary Clinton, and they're getting incredibly nervous. And I think there have been a lot of phone calls to the vice president saying, help.
One of the things that worries me about this is that these stories are so prevalent. Articles that don't beat around the bush, they go straight to it and say, you know, she's a pathological liar, she's a congenital liar. They talk about, with such a record of mendacity, it's a good thing, blah, blah. On it goes. There's no beating around the bush here. So the media, you might say, is doing its job in keeping a check on the executive. But nothing seems to happen, as you say. It just keeps rolling along the same. There's no change coming about because the media have revealed this quite sad trait. Now, why is that? Why is the revelation not producing a change?
I think, Amanda, some of this is maybe happening in slow motion. This is in the hands of the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And, you know, in America, that's kind of a thing you don't ever want to hear, that the FBI
is onto you.
Because they are an independent investigative unit And they've asked for her server. They're getting her records. They're interviewing her staff. That is, I think, out of her control. I mean, I have a fair amount of confidence in the FBI director who by design serves a 10-year term so that he's, you know, he's sort of immune to pressure from the person who appointed him.
Sure.
The president who appointed him, in this case, that's President Obama, but he's a Republican, as a matter of fact. So, but he's got a considerable reputation in the Justice Department and the legal field. So that's out of her control. There's a congressional investigation ongoing. Her former chief of staff in the State Department testified behind closed doors today. We have a very aggressive congressman who is heading this committee investigating her. So she is a long way from out of the woods, and it is entirely possible that something could happen in the next couple months.
And then what will happen? What will the Democrats do then?
Well, if she gets
knocked out, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, if this gets so bad in a PR sense that it just her funding dries up, you know, that would be a big problem for her.
Mm.
Worse still is if she were indicted for something.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but certainly I've listened to a lot of them here in America discuss this on television, and they're, you know, wary of her situation, and that's understating things.
Putting aside the issues of, you know, what happens if she falls out of the race, loses backing of Democrat sponsors, who do they go to? You know, do they go to Sanderson, right, the socialist, or whatever? What does this say, do you think, to people who believe in democracy generally around the world, that you can be such a high-profile person and have such an apparent high profile of lying, and you can still be seen as a legitimate candidate for head of state?
Right.
Doesn't that
right.
say to the couple that I call Bob and Mary Stringbag, just a normal, nice people, you know, your neighbours that
right.
want their kids to
it's
keep...
not the best ad.
Not
sure.
the best ad. It's worse than that. I mean, say something's really wrong?
Well, I do have faith in the American system here. Richard Nixon... you know, was made to resign the presidency in the Watergate scandal.
Yeah.
I do think on occasion I am concerned about the partisan nature of bureaucracies. We had a situation here with the IRS and a woman named Lois Lerner, who was a very high-ranking official in the Internal Revenue Service, and she was clearly using this for political vindictiveness towards, you know, people she disagreed with. Nothing much has happened to her, and the Justice Department should swing into action. But in this situation, I do have some faith. Republicans do have both the House and Senate. They have investigative machinery that they can use and are using on this. And as I say, the FBI is in good hands. The FBI director has to be confirmed by the United States Senate, and he needed Republican votes to be confirmed. So, you know, they were very careful with that. I mean, that's traditionally a nonpartisan sort of appointment. But it's disturbing. It's disturbing. But, you know, the truth will out over time, I think.
Well, that's a saving grace in one sense, isn't it? But to the guy who hasn't been as lucky as some others in terms of his parenting, his education, whatever, you know, he's doing it tough. He works hard. He looks after his family. It's not much consolation
right.
to him to say that the truth will out if the people who do the wrong thing can, over the duration of their lifetime, enjoy the spoils and the fruit of their own evil, and then at the last minute, the last 10 years of their life, get caught out. The guy who's been honest all his life says, "Well, hold on, that's not how it's meant to work."
There's a very interesting thing going on here in the American political system right now with the rise of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And it's directly related to, I think, the kind of thing you're talking about. Within the Republican Party, there was considerable feeling that the so-called establishment, if you will, has paid no attention to the, you know, instructions, as it were, that they're getting from the people who elect them. And there's just furious disgust. And I was just on CNN tonight to discuss a poll that came out today, and it shows Donald Trump running away with this thing. And right behind him, you know, by about 10 or 10 points or so, his closest competitor is Dr. Ben Carson, who is an African-American
Neurosurgeon, isn't he?
Right, neurosurgeon, exactly. The point is that when you add, and there's a couple others that are seen as outsiders, Carly Fiorina, the former Hewlett-Packard chairman, when you add all their numbers together, they reach anywhere between 50, depending on the poll, anywhere between over 50 to 65% of the vote, which really tells you just how furious people are about this kind of thing, and that the political system is filled with people who operate it for their benefit economically and in terms of political power, et cetera. And they very much want somebody who is outside of it, or in the case of Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, in sort of open rebellion against the system. And so far, all of these people are the ones leading in the polls, and the ones that are seen as the establishment types are basically gasping for air, for money. You know, some of them are on the verge of dropping out. I mean, it's quite a fascinating thing to see. And I think that reflects directly in the sentiment that you're talking about.
Mm. Well, Jeffrey, as they say, we live in interesting times. Thanks for joining
us. Indeed, we do. Okay, Amanda, thank you very much.
Jeffrey Lord is a commentator, author, and former advisor to the Reagan administration. Children are our future. It's an easy platitude to mouth, and you hear it all the time. Oh, children are our future. We have to educate them. Yes, well, of course we do. But then we end up in arguments about how to do it. Are we doing it well enough? Enter NAPLAN. Enter a big debate. Is it any good? Is it not any good? What's happening? Well, I think it's time we found out from someone who knows more than I do about what is happening. Is the NAPLAN set of tests doing us any good at all? So joining us now is Jennifer Buckingham. Jennifer's a research fellow in the education program at the Centre for Independent Studies. And she's got some interesting things to say. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, NAPLAN did cause a bit of a fight, didn't it, when it was introduced? All sorts of people arguing, saying this was completely wrong or completely right, and there weren't too many shades of grey offered in there, were there?
Well, any kind of change in education seems to be controversial, particularly any kind of new testing, and that's been the case for as long as I've been looking at education policy, back to when David Kemp was education minister and tried to extend the amount of testing. That's right. Mm-hmm. So each time a new sort of test or a test arrangement is introduced, it's controversial. And NAPLAN, probably more controversial than most, because it seems to create more arguments. You know, around about four times a year, I think, the NAPLAN arguments start again when the results are released, when the kids sit the test, when the test results go home, when my school is updated. So we're in a cycle of NAPLAN discussion every year.
We are, but now we can see some quite interesting things. And one of the things you raised that I thought was interesting is about how early you get onto this, that we're seeing more change at the lower levels than at higher levels of schooling, and that might mean you either get in early or you're too late.
Well, the NAPLAN results, the trends really, that have shown up in the most recent lot of tests have shown that the biggest improvement, the only improvement, to be honest, has been in year three. There are some patchy sort of amounts of improvement in different areas in other years, but year three is where there seems to be the biggest growth. And that confirms what we know about education, and it comes through in studies time and time again, that the earlier that you intervene, the easier it is to see some results. And I personally actually would like to see NAPLAN start earlier. Here's some controversy for you. I'd like to see some reading test at least done in year one, something fairly short and simple.
Mm-hmm.
But I think year three
them used to the
a
idea.
Little bit too late.
Get them used to the time idea it gets that they have to have a test.
That's right, and year three is starting to get a little bit too late to intervene, so mm-hmm. The earlier the better, I feel.
It's not necessarily a bad thing in any event, is it, to do these tests across the later years, because at least you know where you are. I mean, while it's not exciting to find out that we haven't had significant improvement other than in year three, I'd rather know that than be happily sailing along thinking everything was going okay. I mean, it's important to know where you are on a spectrum.
That's right, and that's one of the I think the most or the strongest counters to the idea that NAPLAN is stressful. I think it's much more stressful to get all the way through schooling and then discover that your reading levels are not sufficient to be able to cope with any sort of further education or in the workplace. So it's all relative, and it really depends on the way that schools deal with the NAPLAN testing process, the way parents deal with it. It doesn't have to be a stressful situation. It doesn't have to be a big deal for students. It's just once every 2 years. They do a couple of days worth of testing for an hour or two each day, and it doesn't need to be stressful at all.
Oh, honestly, you depress me. I mean, this business of it being stressful to have a test. Life is made up of tests. They're not always presented as here's a chair, here's a paper and a pencil and answer these questions, but life is full of tests. And kids, when they leave school, are going to face them. They're going to face competition. The sooner they get into that and become comfortable with it and recognise that it's a part of life and that it's not a bad thing to come second, third or fourth or whatever, isn't that a good thing for them to recognise that that is life?
For sure. And it's really not even so much a matter of them being compared to each other in any kind of public way. So their results are not made known to other students. So there's no sort of ranking within classes or anything like that that goes on. The results only go to parents and to teachers. And so then parents can use that information as a reference point, because quite often parents are told their children are doing well and then they discover that actually they're not doing particularly well when their NAPLAN results come home. And it's a way of starting that conversation with the teacher. And it's also a way of teachers seeing how their students are progressing in comparison with children in other schools, in other states. And it's a benchmarking, I suppose, a way for teachers to see their strengths and weaknesses, and then they can zero in on the areas
they could,
that they need to work on.
They could, for example, say, well, I'm asking you, could they say, looking at arithmetic, maths, if you want to call it that, oh, gee, when it comes to dealing with, say, is it detailed as this, down to dealing with fractions, other schools are doing better than my school, so we better do something in the way we teach fractions.
They can get very high levels of detail. They can see, not necessarily comparing with other schools, but comparing with themselves over time and with other students within the class. So,
okay.
When we're sort of
but
talking
one school
about...
Can't, there is... Sorry to interrupt, but just get this clear. I might have said the wrong thing. I didn't mean to say with other schools, as in you can nominate the school, but with a state average or something. You can see
yes.
where you are. Yeah.
Yes, so they can see the proportions of children who have got that question mm-hmm. right, whatever particular question it might be. Mm-hmm. And it allows teachers then to say to themselves that, well, perhaps this is the area that we need to work on. There's something going on here. If our students aren't able to answer this question correctly,
sounds
then we need to
thing.
Look at the way that we're teaching it.
Sounds a good thing to me.
Find it very useful. Schools do find it very useful when it's used in the right way and within the context of other sorts of tests. I'm fortunate enough to be able to work with the school fairly closely, and this is exactly what they do. They use NAPLAN data in all the ways in which it was intended to be used, which is to evaluate their own strengths and weaknesses. There's a little bit of competitiveness, which never hurts, but to make sure that they are performing well against the like school comparisons and against the state average, and they also do all the right things. You know, that some of the criticisms about NAPLAN are that schools exclude students who they don't think will do very well. That's not my experience. The schools that I know make a great effort to include all students because they want to know how those students will do in NAPLAN.
Do you think there should be severe penalties? I give away my bias here because I think there should be, for schools that encourage some kids not to take the test because they'll bring the school average down.
I don't know what sort of penalties there might be.
I think that's a criminal thing to do to a child, to say you might spoil our school. You could dress it up, phrase it whatever way you like. Kids aren't dumb. They know what you mean.
It is wrong, and it disadvantages that student, and it gives a skewed picture of what that school is doing. I don't think that there's a lot of it going on. There's anecdotal evidence that that's the case. I think, you know, it's isolated, that there's no point in doing that. And schools who are doing that, you know, they're not going to benefit from what NAPLAN has to offer. If they're trying to game the system, they're not going to gain anything from it in terms of improving their results.
I get that, and I'm pleased that they're not going to gain from cheating in that way. But my concern is the child to whom they say this, or the children to whom they say this. I mean, good Lord, these kids are in their care. You know, they're meant to be bringing out the best in kids, not putting them aside. But, okay, look, we've dealt with that. You think that's, intermittent and not widely spread, and we shouldn't get too excited about it. But why would some states appear to do better than others? I noticed in the latest set, I think, was it Western Australia and Queensland did better?
Yes, we can only really speculate about that at the state level. Queensland started from a much lower point than other states, and so therefore they had a lot of ground to cover. So their improvement has been relatively good. However, they're still not outperforming the other states on average.
Okay.
At WA, similarly, has had greater gains, but they're not necessarily outperforming other states in all areas. So they're relative gains, really. In terms of the gains in Year 3 reading, there is some speculation that that has been because of a greater emphasis on phonics in the early years of school, and I'd really like to think that was the case. I think there's a lot more room to improve in that particular area. But this is one of the great things about NAPLAN, is that it provides us with this data that we have never had before, and we're seeing a fair bit of research starting to emerge that is more detailed and more specific than just looking at state averages. It's looking at particular schools and comparing the policies and practices of those schools. And all of this is really enlightening, and I think we've really only scratched the surface of what the NAPLAN data can reveal.
Mm. Well, when we were talking about competition, you know, as you say, you can't access other people's results. It's not comparing you with other students, but it is at least comparing you with yourself, competing with yourself. That's probably the most important form of competition you can have to make yourself a better person. You know, years and years ago when I first got into the Senate, so we're talking about early 80s sometime, I decided to have a Senate essay competition. And one of the airlines said they'd foot the bill to fly some students and a teacher to Canberra. And it's actually, I think, the reason both Samantha Maiden, who I think is the political editor for the Sunday Telegraph, and Annabelle Crabb, of all sorts of fame, went into journalism, because they saw the press gallery and understood where news came from. But, you know, we stopped that competition. You know why we stopped it? Because too many schools, in particular government schools, when we rang and said, you know, are you going to enter this year? Because, look, the private schools are winning all the time and it's a bit boring. They said, oh, we don't believe in competition. We don't believe in that. We don't want to expose our students to that while they're at school. And I can remember thinking, those poor kids, get out in the world where there are three rules, compete, compete, compete. It's just unbelievable
sort of
that we don't get
it?
Ready. Well, why don't people understand we have to get kids ready to compete?
And yet, so many schools compete readily in sports. So
yes.
It's a double standard there, isn't there? That there's a reluctance to highlight students who perform well in other areas, whatever it might be, whether it's performing arts or academics, but the same is not applied to sports. So it is a strange sort of double standard.
No, that's a good point about the double standard you've raised. Look, Jennifer, thanks for giving us some time today. I know that you know the NAPLAN system backwards, and it's been good to talk to someone who can point out exactly what it is about and how people needn't be afraid of it, and that it can only do good for the students who participate.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Buckingham is a research fellow in the education program at the Centre for Independent Studies. If you were having a moment where you felt insignificant, I can help you with that. I can make you feel even more insignificant. Or if you're having a moment where you thought you were pretty important, I can help you with that and make you feel pretty insignificant. How? Well, by talking about the universe. It's all downhill from here. That's what our next guest says about the universe. Apparently, its most spectacular phases are over. And although there's much, much more for scientists to see, the peak has come and gone. In fact, the universe is slowly dying. But don't panic just yet. There's life in the old thing yet. Billions of years, in fact. So, to take a look at the highlights of the life of the universe, we're joined by Dr. Aaron Robotham. He's from the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research at the University of Western Australia. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Well, heavens above. I mean, how did this all start? Tell me about this business of the universe being less than a second old.
So we had a big bang. We're pretty confident that this happened. And in that first second, that's when the universe was so, so hot, we were forming spontaneously really, really exotic particles. So particles we can actually just about produce today in the Large Hadron Collider, so the big experiment in CERN. But it's really, really hard. You need very, very high temperatures. But in that early phase of the universe, like very, very exotic, very massive, very unstable, weird particles that we don't commonly see now, they were being made.
Over a period of seconds, we're talking.
Oh, yeah. Only a period of 1 or 2 seconds, you made the really, really energetic stuff, and then the universe was cooling really, really rapidly, so, so quickly that even after a handful of seconds, it was starting to produce kind of not very exotic particles, stuff that we're more familiar with, the stuff that kind of makes this, you know, the things you can tap with your hand, the tables, the chairs, these sorts of things.
And then it pretty well stayed like it was for about 400,000 years.
Yeah, so what we had
is quite a long time, really.
It's quite a long, compared to a few seconds.
But then you say, then quite suddenly, things started to happen again.
Well, we had a long period where we just had a sea of protons and electrons. These are probably fairly they're fundamental particles, but they're kind of familiar. And what happened after 400,000 years, the universe was cool enough that we could suddenly form hydrogen. So this is neutral hydrogen, which, you know, we're all familiar with now. Put it in dangerous balloons, which then explode if you light them. And that's what happened after 400,000 years. The universe was cool enough that you could form hydrogen, and that suddenly meant the light, the photons, which make up light, they could suddenly stream off, and they're no longer bouncing off the electrons. And that's the important thing that happened at 400,000 years, and we call that event decoupling. So it's where light and the electrons became decoupled.
And then we start to form stars.
Oh, that was still quite a lot of... that's a long time later. So then we had to go through this thing called the Dark Ages, where really, really the universe was dark, like nothing was going on. And in the meantime, we were able to start forming bigger... we had fusion going on, so we started to form deuterium and helium and even lithium and some beryllium. And then after many, many millions of years, this helium and hydrogen could start forming the very, very first stars. But we had a long period, which we call the Dark Ages. And literally, if you went there and you happened to be in the universe, it would look very unimpressive. You'd maybe see a very dull kind of red glow, and that'd be it. You wouldn't see anything for a very long time, many millions of years.
After a few hundred million years old, we were heating itself back up, and the first stars were irradiating the surrounding material. They were blowing themselves apart. I mean, it sounds a pretty dangerous sort of place to have been.
Yeah,
stars blowing themselves apart. This doesn't sound calm and relaxed and pretty, does it?
No, that was a very unusual bit of the universe. It looks nothing like it does now. They made these very, very massive stars. We call them population 3 stars, just because astronomers are odd and we count backwards. So in the local universe, we have population 1 and population 2. So the very first ones were population 3, and they were much, much bigger than stars we can make now. Very unstable. They had very short lifetimes. They burnt through their fuel very quickly. And they fused very, very heavy elements, and they exploded on very short timescales. And they kind of seeded these heavier elements like carbon, carbon and nitrogen, oxygen, the kind of stuff we need for life. They seeded those heavier elements in the universe. And then we waited a bit longer, and then a few tens and hundreds of millions of years later, we started to form things that looked more like galaxies, which is what we're familiar with today.
Then you say, enter the dark stuff. Now, this is where Brian Schmidt has got his Nobel Prize for work here, and Australia's played quite a key role in ascertaining what happened in this period.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything we've discussed to now, it really only depended on baryonic material, which is the stuff we're made of, and dark matter. That was important.
Am I?
You're made of baryonic material.
So it sounds much better than I'm 80% water or 90% water, doesn't it?
No, we're all baryons. We're all
wonderful.
That's a really fundamental thing. So we got dark matter, we got baryons, which is the stuff we can touch. And then what was happening in the background, this thing called dark energy, was slowly building up its influence. So in the early universe, it doesn't really have that big an impact. But about 3 billion years ago, it became the dominant form of energy in the universe. So it became more and more dominant. And what Brian Schmidt and Sol Perlmutter and Adam Riess, they won the Nobel Prize for this, they found the universe was accelerating. And that means it's actually not just expanding. And you'd think if you think of something expanding, you think probably that if it's full of matter, it would slow down and it would expand slower and slower. Instead, it's accelerating apart. And this very, very odd substance we call dark energy, really because we don't know what it is causing it to not just expand, but it's like blowing up, it's inflating. And that's what they won the Nobel Prize for.
Okay. Well, people aren't entirely sure about everything associated with dark energy. You talk about exotic theories, including that it could tear everything apart in a big rip. Does that mean that people believe that I could go to bed tonight and then never wake up, not because I've passed away in the normal sense of things, but the big rip has just happened and everything's ripped up and we're not here anymore?
Well, so even in the most exotic extreme theories, like the big rip ones, we'd be talking about that happening in... So the universe is only about 14 billion years old. We'd be talking about that happening hundreds of billions of years. So a very, very long time from
so
now.
So not tonight. I can still plan my telly and do all of that sort of stuff. Now, we're cooling now, aren't we? We're not producing as many stars.
Yeah, so that's exactly right.
So that's the end of the universe, is it?
It's the end of the exciting bit of the universe. Yeah, exactly. We've got all the really cool stuff out of the way. We formed most of our material, most of our stars, most of our planets in the past. And from now, the rate at which we're doing it is just slowing down and slowing down and slowing down. So we'll keep doing it, but it won't be very kind of exciting. It won't be very dramatic. All the really dramatic stuff happened in the past. So we're at least very confident that whilst we'll kind of carry on, and I think, say, for instance, our own star will be here for a good 5 billion years or so yet, we'll find it harder and harder to form new stars. And if you came to the universe in, say, 100 billion years, it would look a pretty dim place compared to now.
It's fascinating that there can be a branch of science that can look at and predict with any degree, if you like, of exactness, things that will happen over billions of years.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's fabulous to understand that. But in that context, it does make your and my life not really very important, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think do you ever take your work and put it as, you know, in contrast, the day-to-day activity, and think how unimportant most of it therefore is?
Weirdly not. I think likely it's to do with how we've evolved as a species, that we're fairly introverted. We tend to concentrate on our own little bubble of the world. We tend to care about our own family. In a sense, we tend to care about our immediate tribe, and we tend not to worry too much, because you'd go crazy if you're really worried about everything else going on in the world or going on in our solar system or going on in the universe. It will do your head in. You can't really cope with it. So it's sort of how I think we've evolved, that we tend to focus on stuff, you know, selfishly to a degree, but it's for practical reasons, stuff that immediately affects us. Otherwise, as a species, we wouldn't really survive.
So the universe is dying, but not for billions of years.
Yeah, I would say we're at, a solid 30-year-old healthy person. And, you know, we've got a good old age to look forward to. We're maybe moving to middle age now, but we've got a solid number of years ahead of us. So, yeah, we're not quite in the grave yet.
All right. Now, are we a universe or are we in an omniverse?
Oh, well, that's a very tough question. What we know for sure is we've got something we call the observable universe. So it's almost like a bubble of the universe, which is as much as we can see.
Yeah.
It's quite possible the universe is, and that's just because it's got a finite age. So if you imagine it's been expanding, it's about 14 billion years old. And that tells us how far light could have possibly travelled in 14 billion years.
Right.
So that's just the bubble we can see. But there could be lots of them. So you imagine you could pack all these pebbles of bubbles of universes together. And it could be there's billions of bubbles. And there's, you know, a bubble, like a universe over, which can't see us yet and vice versa. It could be we're almost the only one, but that looks unlikely. Or there could be an infinite number. Like, we just don't know that for sure. But we do know we've definitely got one bubble we can see, and beyond that,
and we're
absolutely
in that.
No idea.
We're in that, yeah. Thanks for the article. I think it's really interesting. People, most of us don't study this sort of stuff. We rely on people like you to get into it and explain it to us, and you've been very helpful. And I, for one, found it particularly interesting. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're with Amanda Vanstone and Counterpoint here on RN. Next up, The Art of Grace
and moving well through life. What is grace? Some would say it's fluid movement, looking graceful, like a swan or a ballet dancer in full flight. Others would say it's a person who displays elegance and refinement, graciousness. That's what we're going to explore today. Recently, it was announced that Jimmy Carter, former President of the United States, has brain cancer. That's sad news. But of particular interest is the manner in which it was announced and the grace with which he conducted himself. Our next guest has written a book on this very theme and says grace is a rare commodity in today's world. In fact, she says we lost the art of grace somewhere around the 1950s or 60s. So what changed and how do we recapture it? Sarah Kaufman, who's writing a book on grace, in fact wrote an article about the manner in which Jimmy Carter has chosen to face this difficult time of his life. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, what can you tell us about Jimmy Carter and the manner in which he made this announcement?
What was so fascinating to me is that just about the first thing he said when he held his press conference announcing that he had brain cancer in addition to liver cancer, he said he was surprisingly at ease when he heard the news. And then he went on to talk about how grateful he was for a good and joyful life, how much he was still in love with his wife, Rosalyn, how much hope he had for the future, how pleased he was with the work he's doing with the Carter Center and the humanitarian efforts that he's undertaking in Africa. And he expressed a lot of positive hopes for the future. And then he finished up by saying, and I'm going to go and teach Sunday school as usual. So in other words, he didn't talk at all about himself. He put the focus on other people, on the wonderful life that he's had, on gratitude, and on the work to come. Mm. And in so doing, he created this sense of ease in the rest of us. So we don't need to feel sorry for him. He's kind of taken that burden away from us. And instead, he's given us a wonderful example about how to think about your life as being just enough. It's fine the way it is. He's happy where he is, even though he's staring down this diagnosis that could rattle the best of us and scare us and terrify us. He is looking at it as not, you know, it doesn't take away from the wonderful life that he has led and that he is still planning to lead. Mm. And there's something very, very graceful about that.
Mm. You mentioned some of the work he's done in Africa, and in particular, I understand he's done some work in trying to eradicate something called the guinea worm. It's a parasite that once it gets to you can be quite painful, and some decades ago infected, you know, 3.5, nearly 4 million people. And now, because of Carter and the work that he's done with the centres he's helped, villages getting access to clean water, so on, just 11 cases this year. Now, that in itself is a fantastic achievement. You'd think, oh, well, I hope you'd think if you'd done that and played a part in it that, you know, your life had been a useful life and you would be grateful for what you've done. Do you think it's as easy for people who haven't had such a useful life to exhibit that grace? And I ask that because you could say someone with as full a life as Jimmy Carter has had is entitled to be full of regret that it's not going to continue. Whereas someone who hasn't done much with their life, you might say, well, they might face it with more grace because they might say, well, there hasn't been much to it. But here we have a man who's had everything, you might say, and is still gracious about moving on.
Exactly. And in fact, you can look at other former presidents who have not had as successful a post-presidential life as Jimmy Carter has had, because the leaving this platform of great prestige and global renown is difficult, stepping down from that. And I think the example that Jimmy Carter has set is to simply get to work doing something that he loves, that is satisfying, and that has great meaning for him. It doesn't have to have a lot of prestige. It doesn't have to have a lot of television cameras and the whole wide world watching his every move. He is happy simply helping others. I think that that's an example that all of us can follow, even if we're not as well known and we don't have best-selling books and we don't have a household name. The most important thing about grace and graciousness is to be attentive to others. You know, it's a kind of outward-looking quality. Research has shown, social scientists and psychologists have done lots and lots of studies on happiness and what leads to happiness and satisfaction. And indeed, it's not wealth and possessions and material success or even job success. It's more having a sense that you've made a difference somehow, that you've helped others, that is what leads to satisfaction and gives your life meaning. And that's something that all of us can aspire to.
Mm. Well, you describe grace as meaning, elegance, calm, equanimity, and that's how we can, bring grace to our lives. But in contrast, you say that disorganized emotions, the raging thoughts of the worst-case scenarios, are only going to make things worse. Why don't we all realize that? Why can't we just as humans say, that's not going to work, that's chaos?
Yeah, that is the question. We are often captive to our emotions, and especially in a time of great stress, such as when we hear terrible news. And perhaps in actuality, when the news was delivered to Jimmy Carter, you know, who knows what his true reaction was.
Well, his private reaction. Exactly.
But we do know what his public reaction is. And I think that it is taking it slow, taking a breath, not reacting right away, is a way to avoid that chaos. But, you know, we have emotions for a reason, the kind of fight or flight impulse that is hardwired into us so that we react to danger, we react to stress. But we also can take a moment, we can learn a habit of reacting more slowly and thinking a little bit before speaking or thinking before acting.
Mm. Well, who teaches us that? Obviously, parents haven't been teaching it to kids, have they? Because otherwise we would all behave like that. So how can we learn that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, that is part of a lot of spiritual traditions, meditative traditions, religious traditions, the contemplative life. Right, we hear that a lot, and of course, in Jimmy Carter's case, he's a very devout churchgoer, so he's had a lifetime of prayer and attending to a kind of transcendent experience of going to church. That's not the only way to learn about grace, however. And what I go into in my book is that, spiritually speaking, grace is a part of many religious traditions, but it's also kind of hardwired into us and has been taught going back hundreds and even thousands of years. In fact, the very first book the artifact that is considered the very first book a human ever wrote is an ancient Egyptian text that was a set of maxims set out from a father to his son on how to live well. And
heavens above, I thought that was a stocking filler invented by the Christmas merchants a couple of years ago. And you're telling me it's the first book in the world, How to Live Your Life.
Yeah, they've all been ripping off this guy named Ptah Hotep from about 4,500 years ago. And it's fascinating to read what he set forth. It's a lot of advice on how to take care of the people around you. To be bright-faced, he says, and open and helpful. To mind your manners at the table. To, if you are in a position of power, treat those beneath you with kindness and gentleness. Kindness is a man's memorial, he says. And he urges those in a position of power to listen to the gripes of their underlings. So he is setting forth the habit of taking time, not speaking right away, kind of closing your mouth, and just listening. And it's, you know, obviously that was very influential. It was saved. That's why it still exists today. It was copied over and over. There are several versions of the manuscript, of the hieroglyphics. And you find his advice echoing through the ages in Jesuit teachings, in works from the Renaissance that became monster bestsellers, other conduct books that made their way, for instance, into the back pocket of George Washington, who, as a teenage boy, copied out a set of rules of civility and kind behavior that were passed down from court traditions to Jesuits to colonial schools, and he copied them out as a schoolboy, and he kept them for the rest of his life. So he really valued how to treat people. These were all ways on how to treat the people around us, how to put the focus on other people, how to control ourselves, control our bodies, control our reactions, and put your best self forward.
There we are. Now that's a great definition, a short one, I admit, of grace. Put your best self forward. What a great idea. Sarah, thanks for joining us today, and I look forward to reading the book when it comes out.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
To hear the show again or to subscribe to the program, go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. Well, that's it for today. I hope you'll join us again next week. And until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying arrivederci.